Back to the Rabbit Hole Power Hour. This is episode 5. I'm your host, The Format, creator of the show. And today I'm bringing you a few stories from the internets. First up, we got from The Guardian. This is Alexei Navalny protests, Moscow in lockdown as police detain thousands. It's kind of an old story, 6 to 7 minute read from The Guardian. After that, I got a story from naturalnews.com. 4 volunteers immunized with Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine developed Bell's palsy. FDA denies jab caused it. That's a 5 to 6 minute read from naturalnews.com. After that, we're going over to humansarefree.com for a growing list of assassinations of COVID-19 researchers. That's a 6 to 7 minute read. After that, we're switching it up a bit, going to a website called theeraoflight.com for the first documented alien abduction, the Grays from Zeta Reticuli. That's another 6 to 7 minute read. After that, we go to Humans Are Free for a story from experts that found a 1.7 million year old man-made bridge. And after that, we go to our friends at the website that I pronounce bibliotecapleiades.net. I'm not sure if that's how that's supposed to be pronounced, but that's how I've been saying it. And their story, the final story of the day, is called The Reptilians, Humanity's Historical Link to the Serpent Race. Real quick, depending on how you find this, sorry if the audio quality is not very good. I have $20 microphone stand, pop filter combination, and a couple old smartphones that I'm working with over here. So if you have any interest in helping me out, I'm on buymeacoffee.com. I believe it's /formatfmh. I'm not sure why the H is on the end of it, but hit me up. Donate toward buying me a new microphone or a cup of coffee. But anyway, getting on to the stories here. I'm just hanging around seeing if anyone comes into the live. Yeah, and sorry if you hear a lot of like rustling around or lighters flicking or containers opening. Sometimes you gotta drink water, sometimes you gotta do things, gotta smoke. You know how it is. Anyway, first story coming up from The Guardian. This is Alexei Navalny protest in Moscow. Moscow in lockdown as police detain thousands. From TheGuardian.com. Police have paralyzed the centers of Russia's largest cities, including Moscow, as the Kremlin sought to beat back rallies in support of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny, the country's most significant protest in a decade. Supporters of the Kremlin critic took to the streets to protest against his jailing despite biting cold and the threat of arrest. At least 4,500 people, including Navalny's wife, Yulia Navalnaya, were detained as the rallies across the country entered a second week. Taking unprecedented security measures, riot police and National Guard troops shut down 7 central metro stations in Moscow and blocked off streets to prevent a repeat of last week's record protests, some of the largest since 2012. The unsanctioned protest deteriorated into a cat-and-mouse game as riot police, armed with batons and stun guns, pursued protesters through the capital. The hours-long chase was punctuated by clashes and brutal arrests. One man was severely injured after dousing himself with gasoline and setting himself on fire, apparently in an act of protest. He was hospitalized in critical condition. The threat of arrest and violence appeared to reduce the numbers in Moscow compared with last week. Forced out of the center, a crowd of thousands chanting, "Putin is a thief," marched toward Moscow's Komsomolskaya Square, a major retail artery outside the security cordons, as police in body armor made hundreds of arrests. Behind them sped dozens of armored police vans used for mass arrests. Moscow looks like a fortress today, said Maria Lazareva, a protester who found herself trapped between two lines of riot police just off the Komsomolskaya Square. She said, "They can stop us when there are not enough of us, but as more come, it's going to be impossible to keep us penned in." Hundreds chanted freedom as they continued toward the Matroskaya Tishina jail in Moscow, where Navalny is being held before a parole hearing this week that could lead to him being sent to prison for years. Navalny was arrested earlier this month after returning to Russia following a suspected FSB poisoning. "He's the only one willing to fight back and always say the truth," said another protester. "Not everyone here agrees with him, but I think a lot of people respect him." Police in St. Petersburg, Russia's second largest city, took similar security precautions, shutting down Nevsky Prospect, the city's main avenue, to prevent protesters from gathering there. But thousands still gathered on side streets and faced off with riot police, who beat truncheons against their metal riot shields in an effort to scare off crowds calling for Navalny's release. The crowds responded by clapping. The soundtrack of the Navalny protests, which are the claps and the chants. For a second week running, police at moments appeared to be close to losing control of the situation. In Moscow, protesters ran out in the streets, blocking traffic, and multiple videos showed police using stun guns to shock protesters. In one case, until the victim lost consciousness. In St. Petersburg, one police officer was filmed pulling a pistol on protesters after being kicked to the ground. The Kremlin's goal on Sunday was to show that it was ready to take extraordinary measures to prevent Navalny supporters from gathering in cities across the country. In many places, police chased the opposition leader's supporters out of the city center and into the outskirts. In Ekaterinburg, police made arrests on the frozen Issyt River, and in Vladivostok, police followed protesters onto the frozen ice of the Amur Bay. The Biden administration again condemned the crackdown on protests, marking a significant departure from the Trump White House. "The U.S. condemns the persistent use of harsh tactics against peaceful protesters and journalists by Russian authorities for a second week straight." That's coming from the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. "We renew our call for Russia to release those detained for exercising their human rights, including Alexei Navalny." Police had detained more than 4,100 people by evening, according to the OVD Info protest monitoring website. OVD Info counted 4,000 arrests across the country after last week's demonstrations, leaving many opposition supporters behind bars. Police this week arrested Navalny's senior aides for allegedly violating coronavirus restrictions during last week's protests. The largely leaderless crowds in Moscow on Sunday were directed via the Telegram messaging app, which as of late Sunday afternoon had ushered them away from jail back toward the city center. The remote directions were reminiscent of the protests in neighboring Belarus, where Telegram channels opposed to the government of Alexander Lukashenko would direct protesters to sites around the city each week as the government clamped down. The harsh tactics used by police, who were filmed using stun guns on subdued protesters, kicking snow in the faces of demonstrators lying prone, and beating female protesters with batons, also appeared to be calculated decisions to wear down the demonstrators' resolve. To galvanize support at home, in an online video viewed more than 100 million times, Navalny has accused Putin of being the ultimate owner of a sumptuous Black Sea palace, something he has denied. On the eve of the protest, Arkady Rotenberg, a businessman and Putin's former judo sparring partner, said he owned the property. New protests are expected on Tuesday if Navalny is sentenced to prison time, while street demonstrations reversed a prison sentence against him in 2013. Analysts have said that the Kremlin is now less concerned with a potential opposition backlash or likely international condemnation. So there's my first story of the day. Let me know if you have any thoughts on it. I'm going to take a quick little breath, as I always do after the first story of the day. So if you got your lighters out, flick them, and smoke them if you got them. Do you hear that beautiful dead air? That dead air is brought to you by Cannabis Sativa. Today we got Pineapple Express. Anyway, moving right along. Our second story today. This comes from naturalnews.com. And it is called Four Volunteers Immunized with Pfizer's Coronavirus Vaccine Developed Bell's Palsy. FDA denies the jab caused it. Four volunteers who were given Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine in clinical trials developed facial paralysis. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration reported that the four participants experienced Bell's palsy, a rare condition in which one side of the face is temporarily paralyzed. While the FDA did not state that the vaccine directly caused the paralysis, it warned that doctors should watch out for the side effect and promised to observe cases closely. The FDA revealed this side effect in a report about Pfizer's vaccine, which was made in partnership with German firm BioNTech. The report was released days before the U.S. regulator was scheduled to review the pharmaceutical firm's emergency use authorization. According to the FDA, less than 0.5% of trial participants, including the four cases of Bell's palsy, experienced serious side effects. One experienced facial weakness within 3 days after immunization, but was back to normal after a few days. Another participant developed Bell's palsy 9 days after receiving the jab, while two others experienced facial paralysis 37 and 48 days following vaccination. These three volunteers eventually recovered from Bell's palsy after 10 to 21 days. The National Institute for Neurological Disorders and Stroke defines Bell's palsy as a form of temporary facial paralysis or weakness on one side of the face, resulting from the dysfunction of the facial nerve, which is in charge of facial muscles. It generally affects only one side of the face, but has been known to affect both sides in rare cases. Most people who experience Bell's palsy notice that one side of their face starts to droop and their facial muscles weaken. Some get headaches or experience pain around the jaw or ear of the paralyzed side. In other cases, people lose their sense of taste or become more sensitive to sound. The exact cause of Bell's palsy is unknown, but it usually goes away by itself. However, muscle weakness stemming from the condition may be permanent in some cases. The U.S. and the U.K. approved the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine for emergency use despite the risks it may carry. Despite the risk of developing Bell's palsy, the FDA authorized the Pfizer-BioNTech BNT162b2 vaccine for emergency use in the U.S. on December 11th. In a statement, the U.S. vaccine regulator said it has determined that the vaccine has met the statutory criteria for approval. According to the FDA, there was more than enough data proving that BNT162b2 may be effective at preventing COVID-19. The agency also said that the potential risks associated with the vaccine do not outweigh its potential benefits based on the data presented, which supports the jab's use in people 16 years old and above. FDA Commissioner Dr. Stephen Hahn said that the emergency use authorization for the Pfizer-BioNTech jab is a significant milestone in battling the devastating coronavirus pandemic that has affected so many families in the U.S. and around the world. Prior to the FDA's authorization, the United Kingdom gave BNT162b2 the go signal to be used for vaccination. Mass immunization for COVID-19 in the country commenced on December 8th. The Wall Street Journal reported that the two National Health Service workers experienced anaphylactic reactions after receiving the Pfizer vaccine. Both workers were found to have a history of allergy and have been using adrenaline auto-injectors to deal with their allergic reactions. As a result, the UK's vaccine regulator, Medicine and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, MHRA, updated its warning and advised people who have a history of significant reaction to medicines, food, or vaccines to avoid immunization with the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID jab. The UK's health system previously warned against vaccinating pregnant and lactating women with the BioNTech jab, as its effects on fertility are still unknown. Meanwhile, the NHS has announced that it would make resuscitation facilities available at all times for vaccinations, and that immunization should only be carried out in facilities where resuscitation measures are available. VaccineInjuryNews.com has more on the negative effects of vaccines on human health. Sources for this article include TheGatewayPundit.com, DailyMail.co.uk, NINDS.NIH.gov, FDA.gov, WSJ.com, Breitbart.com, and LifeSiteNews.com, as well as NaturalNews.com. And next up, we're going back to humansarefree.com with a growing list of assassinations of COVID-19 researchers. The recent death of the Russian scientist Alexander Sasha Kagansky adds to the growing list of people engaged in coronavirus research dropping dead in mysterious circumstances. Alexander Kagansky was working on a COVID-19 vaccine before allegedly being stabbed and thrown from the window of his 14th floor apartment. Below I will include five more cases of people who were involved in COVID-19 research or closely related to the events since the pandemic and have either been killed or found dead in mysterious circumstances. Number 2, Canadian scientist Frank Plummer. Key to coronavirus investigation, assassinated in Africa. In early February, renowned scientist Frank Plummer, who received Saudi SARS coronavirus sample and was working on coronavirus vaccine in the Winnipeg-based Canadian lab, was assassinated in Kenya soon after it was revealed in Great Game India investigation that Frank Plummer was the key to the Chinese biological espionage case at Winnipeg's National Microbiology Laboratory. It was from this Canadian lab that coronavirus was smuggled by Chinese biowarfare agents and weaponized in Wuhan. Number 3, Professor Bing Liu from the University of Pittsburgh. In May, Professor Bing Liu of the University of Pittsburgh, who was on the verge of a breakthrough in scientific understanding of the new coronavirus, was shot dead. He was found in his townhouse with gunshot wounds to the head, neck, torso, and extremities. Bing was on the verge of making very significant findings toward understanding the cellular mechanisms that underlie SARS-CoV-2 infection and the cellular basis of the following complications. His colleagues at the university said this in a statement. Number 4. Geeta Ramji, an HIV scientist. Geeta Ramji, an HIV scientist, died of coronavirus when she was in London to deliver a lecture in March. On her return to South Africa, she felt unwell and was hospitalized. Her specialization in HIV prevention and treatment research led her to lead the expansion of Phase 1 through Phase 3 HIV prevention and treatment clinical trials in the Greater Durban area as the Clinical Trials Unit Principal Investigator. And number 5, World Health Organization driver carrying coronavirus samples was shot dead in Myanmar. And that was in May. The World Health Organization vehicle carrying coronavirus test samples came under attack, leaving the driver dead and a government official seriously injured. P.A. Son Win Maung was driving a well-marked United Nations vehicle when it was hit by gunfire in Rakhine State. Number 6. Vaccine whistleblower Brandy Vaughn. Brandy Vaughn was found dead inside her home as police open investigation. Vaccine whistleblower Brandy Vaughn, a former sales executive for the pharmaceutical company Merck and the founder of LearnTheRisk.org, a website dedicated to educating people on the risks associated with vaccines, was found dead in her home beside her 9-year-old son on December 8th. On Monday, the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Office announced an investigation into the circumstances surrounding her death. There are also those researchers of interest who could be investigated for their shady role in manufacturing the worldwide pandemic of fear. Below, we highlight a couple of them who are key to coronavirus investigation. Peter Daszak of the EcoHealth Alliance. The president of EcoHealth Alliance, Peter Daszak, who is alleged to be the one who orchestrated the myth that COVID-19 is natural in origin. Emails obtained by U.S. Right to Know show that a statement in The Lancet, authored by 27 prominent public health scientists, condemning, quote, conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin, was organized by employees of EcoHealth Alliance. EcoHealth Alliance, interestingly, is the same nonprofit group that received millions of dollars of U.S. taxpayer funding to genetically manipulate coronaviruses with scientists at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Dutch virologist Ron Fouchier, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, created a mutant H5N1 virus and is key to coronavirus investigation. He is also a controversial figure in the field of viroscience. He created the world's deadliest virus strain, and his research sparked a global controversy to defund and shut down such experiments. Experts have raised concerns legally that such experiments could not only lead to a global pandemic, but could also lead to bioterrorism. However, Ron Fouchier is also a key to the COVID-19 investigation. He isolated the SARS coronavirus smuggled out of Saudi Arabia, which was sent to Canadian scientist Frank Plummer, who ended up dead a week after Great Game India's report was published. GreatGameIndia.com is an additional source, as well as Humans Are Free. All right. Where's our alien people out there? For those who get tired of government conspiracies, we have an alien story, and this comes from EraOfLight.com. This is the first documented alien abduction, Grays from Zeta Reticuli. It's about 6 to 7 minutes. The first abduction on record. This case was discovered almost by accident. On September 19, 1961, Betty and Barney Hill were driving home on a road in rural New Hampshire. They were a racially mixed couple. Barney was black and Betty was white. The only reason I mention this is because in 1961, race relations were tense at best, and a couple in such an environment would be less likely to want to draw any undue attention to themselves. However, because a physician initially thought it might be the underlying cause for emotional problems the couple later developed, their incredible story came to light. The Betty and Barney Hill abduction. As they drove down the highway, a disc-shaped object flew over the car. It stopped and hovered 200 yards away from them. They were avid bird watchers, so they had binoculars with them in the car. Imagine Barney's shock when he got out of the car and saw through the binoculars that there were creatures in the portholes of the disc looking back at him. Basically, he panicked. He ran back to the car and the two sped off. Later, they started feeling a little strange and noticed they could not remember the previous 30 miles they had just driven. Also, their watches were no longer running. They had stopped cold. Missing time. Over the next several weeks, Betty began to have weird dreams, and the couple began to recall other odd things that had occurred on their road trip. Looking back, they realized their trip had taken 2 hours longer than normal, and they couldn't figure out why. This later became the first recorded case of missing time. They also had no recollection of what they did during this 2 hour period of missing time. Physical evidence. The next day, the Hills found 12 bright circles about the size of a half dollar on their car. When they placed a compass over the circles, the needle spun wildly. Better see a doctor. Barney began to exhibit a number of physical symptoms. A doctor attributed them to stress, since there seemed to be no other cause. Barney was next referred to a psychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon, in an effort to find the cause of the symptoms. As a part of his treatment, Barney began to undergo hypnosis. After the first session, the psychiatrist decided that both Barney and Betty should be treated and hypnotized separately. The independent sessions were set up so that neither Betty nor Barney would have any conscious recollection of what they independently said. This was done so that neither could discuss with the other what they had told Dr. Simon. Each session was tape recorded. What really happened? Over a period of several months, Betty and Barney told Dr. Simon a story of what really happened on that night. To say it was startling would be an understatement, but both of them were telling the exact same story, each from their own respective vantage point. That is, each story corroborated the other. They had been picked up by alien beings and taken aboard a spacecraft. They were both subjected to a number of medical procedures. Barney had sperm extracted, and Betty recalled being told that the beings were performing a pregnancy test on her. Betty had a long needle inserted into her navel. This was decades before amniocentesis was developed by Earth scientists. The star map. One of the most remarkable things about the Hill case, besides being the first abduction case on medical record, was a star map. The aliens had shown Betty a map consisting of stars and lines drawn between the stars. Betty was later able to draw the map while under hypnosis. They then asked her if she knew where her planet was on the map. When she was unable to tell them, they abruptly ended the conversation without telling her any more. Though Barney died in 1969, NBC made a movie out of the Hills case, entitled The UFO Incident. It starred James Earl Jones and Estelle Parsons as Betty and Barney Hill. The little gray guys are Zetas. Marjorie Fish, an astronomer, took Betty's map and began to convert it into a three-dimensional model to see if she could find out where these beings were from. When a new catalog of stars, the Gliese catalog, was released, she was able to come up with a final version that seemed to make sense. The catalog allowed Fish to assign accurate distances between the stars. The map indicated that the beings were from a planet circling a twin sun star system, Zeta Reticuli, which consists of two stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2. Zeta Reticuli is very close to us in terms of space distance. The planet is only 37 light years away, or 220 trillion miles. The two stars are also a billion years older than our sun. Fish's model was later confirmed by a computer. That is why the aliens we often call little gray guys are sometimes also known as Zetas. Trade routes. Some contactees were told in the 1960s that intelligent life is more often found in twin star systems, and that our solar system is unusual, since we have life with only one sun. The MIT astronomer Fred Ratio says, "You get the impression that most solar systems are not like ours." On August 19, 1998, the front page of the Los Angeles Times featured an article about leading astronomer Andrea Gies. Using the Keck telescope in Hawaii, the largest of its kind in the world, Gies determined and declared that almost all new stars in the universe are, in fact, born as twins. Betty Hill had been given additional information by her alien companions. They told her that the lines drawn between the stars were trade routes. The thick lines were busy trade routes, the thinner lines were routes used less often. Dotted lines represented occasional expeditions. And that's from eraoflight.com. Go check them out. And next up, we're back to humansarefree.com. And this is a story about a 1.7 million year old man-made bridge discovered, shattering mainstream history. This bridge is the ultimate evidence that humans have been on Earth much longer than thought, than previously thought. The ratio of 10 to 1 fits the actual measurements of the bridge observed today. The former director of the Geological Survey of India believes he has found the ultimate evidence of a 1.7 million year old man-made bridge, which indicates mankind existed on Earth millions of years ago and had the ability to erect sophisticated structures long before mainstream experts suggest. This, however, goes against everything we've been told since, according to mainstream scientists, humans have been on Earth roughly 200,000 years. But the alleged bridge throws everything that scientists believed true into questions. The structure, which is visible from space, occupies a relatively large area stretching from India to Sri Lanka. Curiously, ancient Hindu legends suggest that King Rama, a Hindu deity, built a bridge of similar proportions more than a million years ago. According to the Hindu tradition, this strip of land is a bridge built by Hindu god Rama, as told in the Hindu epic Ramayana. Rama is one of the most famous manifestations of the supreme god and is recognized as the image, the spirit, and consciousness of Hinduism, one of the oldest religions in the world. In fact, since ancient times, it is known as the Bridge of Rama or Rama Setu. The Indian epic Ramayana tells the story of the land bridge and how it was built to serve Hindu god Rama in order to help him cross the water to reach the large island and rescue his beloved one from the clutches of the demon king Ravana. It's a story of love, brave deeds, and incredible constructions. Some refer to the alleged bridge as the Rama Setu, while others call it Adam's Bridge, and many believe it is one of the best pieces of evidence that humans have existed on Earth much longer than we're told. And the scientist who claims that this is legitimate is Dr. S. Badrina Rayanan, former director of the Geological Survey of India. Former coordinator of the survey division of the National Institute of Ocean Technology. He studied core samples of the bridge and is apparently convinced that we're not looking at a natural formation, as other scientists have said, but rather at a man-made structure and at one that was erected more than a million years ago. According to reports, Dr. Badrina Rayanan performed a survey of this structure and concluded that it was man-made. He and his team drilled 10 boreholes along the alignment of Adam's Bridge. What he discovered was startling. About 6 meters below the surface, he found a consistent layer of calcareous sandstone, corals, and boulder-like materials. His team was surprised when they discovered a layer of loose sand some 4 to 5 meters further down, and then hard rock formations below that. A team of divers went down to physically examine the bridge. The boulders that they observed were not composed of a typical marine formation. They were identified as having come from either side of the causeway. Dr. Badrina Rayanan also indicates that there is evidence of ancient quarrying in these areas. His team concluded that materials from either shore were placed upon the sandy bottom of the water to form the causeway. In a special discussion board on Reddit, Dr. Badrina Rayanan said, "It is not a natural formation. The top portion of it appears to be a man-made structure. To understand what I am saying from the geological point of view, you have to get to know several things. What is known as Adam's Bridge is originally a natural grade divide separating the Bay of Bengal and the Indian Ocean to the south, so the geological aspects are different on either side." He added, "We found marine sands on top, and below that was a mixed assemblage of corals, calcareous sandstones, and boulder-like materials. Surprisingly, below that, up to 4 to 5 meters, or 13 to 16 feet, again we found loose sand, and after that, hard formations were under that." He added that, "Below the corals and the boulders, we're getting loose sand, which means it is not natural. However, the Ramayana, the bridge is said to have been built upon a wooden foundation, which was placed atop a pre-existing natural elevation that was then covered with large and small stones. But obviously there are many who disagree. One of them is Suvrat Kier, a geologist who specializes in marine formations, who firmly believes we are looking at nothing more than a natural formation." Writing about the alleged bridge, Dr. Kier said, "During the Pleistocene or Ice Age period, glacial buildup and melting forced fluctuations in sea level by tens of meters, setting up the conditions for several episodes of coral reef and sand shoal formation. During periods of large sea level drops in the Pleistocene or the Pleistocene, there would have been a land connection between India and Sri Lanka, but at the end of the last Wisconsin glaciation, the sea level began to rise worldwide." Sources include ancient-code.com, Rediff Magazine, and Dr. Kier on Blogspot, as well as humansarefree.com. So, getting ready for the last story of the day in just a minute. Sorry for the dead air and the awkward pause. Alright, over to our friends at bibliotechopleiades.net, who bring us a story of The Reptilians, Humanity's Historical Link to the Serpent Race, by Joe Lules, Ph.D. Joe Lules is an independent researcher currently working on a book dealing with UFOs and their religious implications. He is collecting stories about encounters with reptilians and invites readers with such experiences to write him in care of Fate magazine. Did humans evolve from reptiles? As long as humanity has kept records of its existence, legends of a serpent race have persisted. These myths tell of a mysterious race of superhuman reptilian beings who descended from the heavens to participate in creating humankind and to teach the sciences, impart forbidden knowledge, impose social order, breed with us, and watch over our development. These serpent-like beings were not alone, but were part of a retinue of super beings thought to be gods by the ancients. Yet, in cultures as widespread and diverse as those of Sumeria, Babylonia, India, China, Japan, Mexico, and Central America, reptilian gods have been feared and worshipped. To this day, the dragon and serpent signify divine heritage and royalty in many Asian countries, while in the West, the serpent represents wisdom and knowledge. The symbol of two serpents coiled around a staff, originally signifying the tree of knowledge of ancient myth, known as the caduceus, is today used by the American Medical Association as its logo. Interestingly, stories of reptilian beings who exercise mind control over human captives while performing medical procedures on them, have been emerging from the research of some of the best-known UFO investigators, such as Bud Hopkins, John Carpenter, Linda Moulton Howe, Yvonne Smith, and others. These stories, told by average, mentally competent Americans, have emerged independently of one another in different parts of the country, but have not yet received much public attention. They tell of human encounters with creatures that have distinctly reptilian features, webbed, claw-like hands, large golden eyes with vertical slit pupils, scaly, greenish-brown skin. Such stories have circulated around the UFO research community for many years, but few experts have had any idea of how to interpret the tales. So unbelievable and so frightful are they that in the past, many researchers merely filed them away in their minds for future reference, rather than risk looking foolish or being ridiculed. Little by little, at UFO conferences around the country, abductees and researchers learned of each other's similar experiences with reptilian creatures, and gradually the stories became public. Today, researchers agree that there is a variety of entities involved in the alien abduction scenario, including the familiar grays, tall human-looking blondes or Nordics, the reptilians or the Anunnaki, hybrids, half-human, half-alien, and in addition, there seem to be variations of each of these that imply crossbreeding and considerable diversity. It's not clearly understood how each type interacts with the others, although they're often reportedly seen together. John Carpenter has kept close track of the abduction phenomenon. He is the director of abduction research at the Mutual UFO Network, one of the largest and most credible organizations dedicated to the scientific study of UFOs and abductions. Carpenter holds a master's degree in social work and is a highly qualified hypnotherapist who works as a psychiatric social worker in Springfield, Missouri. Since the late 1980s, he has worked with more than 100 abductees and compiled information on hundreds of others. In addition, he is in contact with other researchers in the field. He has been involved in 10 cases where experiences have described reptilian entities, and he is aware of researchers in other parts of the country with similar cases. Abductees often have distinct claw-like cuts and bruises on their bodies after their apparent abductions. Carpenter summarized what he knows of these beings in his regular column, Abduction Note, in the Mutual UFO Network Journal, April 1993. Typically, these reptilian creatures are reported to be about 6 to 7 feet tall, upright with lizard-like scales, greenish to brownish in color, with claw-like, four-fingered, webbed hands. Their faces are said to be a cross between a human and a snake, with a central ridge coming down from the top of the head to the snout. Adding to their serpent-like appearance are their eyes, which have vertical slits in their pupils and golden irises. Perhaps the most frightening and most controversial part of these stories are claims that the creatures occasionally are reported to have sex with abductees. Supporting Carpenter's findings is a Mutual UFO Network study that had financial assistance from the Fund for UFO Research. This massive study, known as the Abduction Transcription Project, is an attempt to collect and correlate information on hundreds of abduction cases through the use of a sophisticated computer database. In July 1995, at the organization's symposium in Seattle, Washington, Dan Wright summed up the findings based on 142 separate cases and 560 transcriptions. Wright said, "A fair reading of those sessions indicates strongly that multiple groups of entities have been routinely intruding into the lives of Americans, children as well as adults. When a so-called reptilian is repeatedly described as having the same scaly skin tone, claws for fingers, and an extreme interest in sexuality, one must pay attention. The study's preliminary results indicate that reptilian types have been reported in a relatively small percentage, less than 20% of the cases being studied." Whether the beings reported by abductees are grays, blondes, reptilians, or any other variety, the scenario of the abduction phenomenon is fairly consistent among the thousands of cases studied thus far. In addition to having numerous medical procedures performed on them, abductees also report receiving information in the form of symbols or images, the meaning of which is often unclear, but much of it has to do with future Earth disasters. The beings sometimes refer to themselves as the Watchers, Custodians, or Guardians of Mankind, and all living things on Earth, and they say they are preparing for the time in the near future when global changes will dramatically affect life on our planet. In some cases, they have indicated that they come from various parts of the universe, including other galaxies, or from a very distant place. In what is certainly the most disturbing aspect of the procedures reported, both men and women abductees, but most often women, report being shown rooms filled with hundreds of glass tubes where hybrid fetuses are being grown, much like a hydroponic garden. In many cases, experiencers are shown nurseries of hybrid infants or rooms full of hybrid children of varying ages. Often the beings bring an infant or a child to the woman to be held and loved, as they are told it is their child. These events were reported by alien abductee Betty Andreasen Luca, whose case has been the subject of investigation for more than 20 years, and who has been the subject of four books by UFO investigator Ray Fowler. In his book, The Watchers, Fowler reports on a hypnosis session in which Betty remembered being told by the beings who had taken her aboard their ship that man will become sterile. Man will become sterile because of the polluted environment. Further, she is told that there are good and bad watchers, which Betty refers to as angels. She is warned that there are some who are against man that will hurt and destroy man. References to watchers, good and bad angels, and hybrid babies can be found in many ancient texts, including the Old Testament, which borrowed much from older documents, including the books of Enoch. The prophet Enoch is mentioned in Genesis as the son of Cain and the father of Methuselah, and he is believed to be the one of the antediluvian or pre-flood patriarchs who, along with Noah, walked with God, from Genesis 5:24 and 6:9. Books written by anonymous writers but credited to Enoch were given great credence by early Jewish scholars and thus influenced the writers of the Old Testament. Parts of the books of Enoch written in Aramaic were found among the scraps of parchment in the caves of Qumran in 1947, having been placed there nearly 2,000 years ago by a Jewish sect known as the Essenes, Essenes. These, of course, are the Dead Sea Scrolls. Another version exists in Ethiopian. A According to the Aramaic texts, Enoch was the first among the children of men born of the earth who had learned writing, science, and wisdom from the angels. In one writing, the Book of the Watchers, we learn that the Watchers are angels and that there are good and bad Watchers. We're told that the Watchers are angels of the Lord, come down to earth to instruct the children of men and to bring about justice and equity on earth. But in the case of the wicked or bad angels, the science they teach turns to wicked ends because of their sins. Their sin is that they permit their sexual appetite to dominate them. When the evil Watchers descended and beheld the daughters of man, they began to corrupt themselves with them. When the sons of God saw the daughters of man, they could not restrain their inclination. These Watchers fall from grace with God when Enoch travels to heaven in physical form to testify against them. He tells God that the Watchers had begun to go unto the daughters of men, so that they became impure. As punishment for the sins of the evil Watchers against humankind, God destroys humanity, including the hybrid race of beings who are the offspring of humans and Watchers, by causing a great flood. The evil Watchers are put into a fiery pit and imprisoned by the four chiefs of the good Watchers, the archangels, Michael, Sariel, Raphael, and Gabriel. Another interesting reference to the Watchers was found in the same cave as the books of Enoch, but was not known until 1992, when two biblical scholars, Robert Eisenman and Michael Wise, published their book, The Dead Sea Scrolls Uncovered. Among the 50 documents released for the first time in this book is a reference to the Watchers that is unique, because it provides one of the few physical descriptions of them. The text, called the Testament of Amram, describes the experience of a person named Amram in which an angel and a demon were wrestling over his soul. I saw Watchers in my vision, the dream vision. Two men were fighting over me. I asked them, "Who are you that you are thus empowered over me?" They answered me, "We have been empowered and rule over all mankind." They said to me, "Which of us do you choose to rule you?" I raised my eyes and looked. One of them was terrifying in his appearance, like a serpent, his cloak many-colored, yet very dark. And I looked again, and in his appearance, his visage like a viper, I replied to him, "This Watcher, who is he?" He answered me, "This Watcher and his three names are Belial, and Prince of Darkness, and King of Evil." Or it actually says Kind of Evil. What makes this testament even more intriguing is the fact that this little-known character named Amram is quite an important personage. Amram, it turns out, was the father of one of the most famous contactees in history, the man who delivered the Jews from slavery in Egypt. This person, of course, is none other than Moses. If that were the only reference to reptilian beings in ancient texts, it could easily be dismissed. But the stories of such creatures date back to the earliest human writings, those of Sumer, meaning Land of the Guardians, Babylon, meaning Gate of the Gods, and other civilizations of ancient Mesopotamia. Among the thousands of clay tablets that have been recovered and translated dating back from earliest recorded history, are documents that record events dating back 240,000 years. One of these, the Sumerian King List, tells the story of the god Anu, chief god of an extraterrestrial race called the Anunnaki, and his sons Enki and Enlil. It is clear from the text and the illustrations left by the Sumerians that at least some of these gods, including Enki, were reptilian in appearance. It is Enki who gave the first people the fruit of the tree of knowledge and who later saved humanity by warning a Noah-like figure of the great flood. These stories are so similar to the Old Testament that one can only conclude that the Old Testament authors borrowed heavily from them. In the Sumerian tale, Enki is given the task of creating a worker force to help the Anunnaki till the soil and mine the ore which they came to Earth for. This he does through considerable trial and error, in the process creating strange creatures. The legend implies that Enki possessed a highly advanced technology that included the capability of genetically altering the indigenous species. Using a mysterious process to create a clay-like substance, he was able to bind upon it the image of the gods, indicating that Enki used Anunnaki genes to create a hybrid species. It also implies that some of the early humans may have had a reptilian appearance. Our reptilian ancestors. As ridiculous and repugnant as this sounds, it is commonly accepted by modern science that humankind's early ancestors may have been reptiles. According to the Darwinian explanation of the origins of the human species, mammals evolved from reptiles and gained dominion over the earth only after a great disaster and debatable nature destroyed the dinosaurs. I'm sorry, a great disaster of debatable nature destroyed the dinosaurs. It is theorized that only then were mammals able to proliferate and ultimately evolve into intelligent beings. It is rather remarkable that the ancient Sumerian story of creation should parallel so closely the Darwinian view. In both cases, humans are said to be related to a superior reptilian race, and in both cases, a great cataclysm eradicates the earlier species. In the Bible, it was the hybrid race of giants known as the Nephilim that God wished to destroy. Finally, in both stories, the survivors of the disaster start anew, eventually evolving into humans. In his book, The Dragons of Eden, esteemed astronomer Dr. Carl Sagan speculates on the reptilian origins of humans and on the mysterious leap in brain evolution that can be found in the fossil record. He notes that if people had evolved naturally from reptiles, as Darwinists claim, it should have taken 200 million years for mammals to first evolve, and then another 5 to 10 million years for humans to evolve. But he notes, with extreme puzzlement, that the fossil record simply does not bear out this conclusion. In fact, the evolvement of mammals, and particularly humans, was accomplished very quickly in a major burst of brain evolution. The evidence for this is clear in the fact that stone tools do not appear gradually, but rather they appear in enormous abundance all at once. In frustration, Sagan concludes that there is no way to explain this unless Australopithecines had educational institutions to teach tool making. Of course, there is another explanation, but not one that any mainstream scientist would dare to consider. That alternative is to admit that God or godlike beings had a hand in accelerating the evolutionary process. The reptile part of the brain. Sagan goes on to puzzle over the similarities between the reptilian brain and the human brain. He points out that at the core of the human brain lies a vestige of our reptilian past. This part of the brain, known as the R-complex, or reptilian complex, is said to be the part of the mind that performs the dinosaur functions. Aggressive behavior, territoriality, ritual, and the establishment of social hierarchies. The middle layer is called the limbic system and is thought to generate love, hate, compassion, and sentimentality characteristics believed to be strictly mammalian. The largest part of the human brain, the neocortex, or outer layer, is believed to be the home of reasoning and deliberation, and the place where we know the difference between good and evil. Once again, science seems to agree with the ancient myths, for it was the knowledge of good and evil given to them by a serpent that caused the first woman and then man to fall from grace with their creator. If the creator was reptilian, then it could be that by becoming mammalian and developing a neocortex, humanity became less reptilian, thus falling from grace. ancient texts bear out this disturbing conclusion. In 1945, in a small town in Egypt, a clay jar was found bearing ancient scrolls similar to the Dead Sea Scrolls. These are known as the Nag Hammadi texts, named after the town that they were found. They tell the story of human creation this way. The bodies of Adam and Eve were overlaid with a horny skin that was as bright as daylight, like a luminescent garment. Thus, it seems, they didn't need clothing. Further, these texts tell a far different story about the Tree of Knowledge than the one told in Genesis. It says, "She took some of its fruit and ate, and she gave to her husband also. Then their minds opened. For when they ate, the light of knowledge shone for them. When they saw their makers, they loathed them, since they were beastly forms. They understood very much." In another ancient Jewish document known as the Haggadah, it is made clear that the serpent was not merely a snake. It says, "Among the animals, the serpent was notable. Of all of them, he had the most excellent qualities, in some of which he resembled man. Like man, he stood upright on 2 feet, and in height, he was equal to the camel. His superior mental gifts caused him to become an infidel. It likewise explains his envy of man, especially his conjugal visits. In punishment for tempting Eve, God said, 'I created you to be king over the animals, but you were not satisfied. I created you of upright posture, therefore you shall go upon your belly.' These tantalizing clues from the dim past seem to give at least some support for the idea that today's UFO occupants, reptilian or otherwise, are exactly who they say they are, the ancient guardians of humankind. If that is so, then the theory that UFOs are piloted by aliens from other planets must be carefully reevaluated. But whatever the answer is, it is clear that UFO researchers have their hands full in dealing with this enduring and perplexing mystery. And that's all I have for today. That was a story called The Reptilians, Humanity's Historical Link to the Serpent Race, from bibliotechapleiades.net. And that's my hour for today. So I thank you all for joining me. As always, talk to you later and have a great day. Alright, everything is powering down, so to those of you on Podbean and Spreaker, thanks for tuning in. Catch me next time. See you later.